This is Cave Scott Allen of OTicker.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This episode of Herding Code is brought to you by Runscope Radar. Runscope Radar is a tool for automated testing and monitoring of your app's API interactions. Broken backend services means broken apps, and Runscope Radar allows you to verify that your app's APIs are up and returning correct data as often as every minute. It offers flexible assertions, change requests, and integration with popular services like PagerDuty, New Relic Insights, Keen.io, HipChat, and more. You can sign up for free at runscope.com/herdingcode for a free standard account. That's a $29 a month value. Runscope. Everything is going to be 200. Okay.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on June 11th in the year 2014. Today's guest is Hadi from JetBrains. I know a lot of people know JetBrains and their tools, ReSharper, WebStorm, all that great stuff. So Hadi, I'm glad you're here, but the topic for today is not any of those tools. We wanted to start off with Kotlin. Can you tell us what Kotlin is, what it's about?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. I'm glad to be here. So Kotlin is a programming language that we've been developing for about 2 or 3 years now. And it still actually hasn't been released even in beta. And it's a statically typed programming language that targets the JVM and also targets JavaScript. And it kind of originated out of the idea that, we need something ourselves. So we kind of decided to build it.
So you're using it to build some of the tools that you ship?
Yeah, I mean, so the thing is that, I mean, if you look at JetBrains history, we've been doing programming tools for a variety of languages for over 14 years now. And half of it is like all of the IntelliJ IDEA-based tools are built off of the JVM platform using Java. And then we have the .NET side using C#. And to date, despite having, IntelliJ is such a polyglot environment and it's supports so many different languages, and we've provided parsers and support for all of these languages, we haven't managed to find one that kind of fits the needs that we are looking for. So that's why kind of Kotlin was born. The idea is that we start to use it ourselves. And in fact, we are using it ourselves now internally. The idea of Kotlin was born out of, let's create a language that we can use ourselves, that we can port our stuff over and moving forward use this language. And then if people want to use it, if other people want to use it, then awesome. If they don't, well, they don't. But primarily it was for ourselves.
So the source code to this is on GitHub, so anyone can play with it.
Yeah, it's an open source language. It's a Apache 2 license because, hey, if you're on the JVM, you got to do Apache 2. And it's on GitHub. And while, it's primarily developed and sponsored by JetBrains, there's about 12 people working on it inside JetBrains. We do have external contributors. I think there's been about 100 or something like that. Different contributors. I got to check that out actually. But yeah, I mean, it's on GitHub open source, just like everything else. You can't, I mean, who would in their right mind design a language nowadays that's closed source? Swift.
Bless you.
It's funny you brought up Swift. I mean, I don't know if now's the time to ask about it, but I was wondering, as I was looking, I've been reading Swift source code and I was reading Kotlin source code, and there do seem to be some small similarities. Is that just me or?
No, I think there is. I mean, I don't know when exactly Swift was started. I heard something around that it was started back in 2010. So I don't know exactly the date. Then from others, I've heard that they've been actually working on it for 7 years or something. But there are similarities, of course, and it looks quite similar. And there's a lot of similar concepts between Kotlin and Swift. But I wouldn't dare say that, they were inspired to all extent by Kotlin. I would say that probably they were inspired a lot by Groovy. And I'm guessing that a lot of the inspiration and a lot of the things that we have in Kotlin, it was also kind of inspired by Groovy. So I would say that, probably something like Groovy is common in the background of both languages. Because I honestly, it would be far-fetched to me to say, oh yeah, they basically inspired it off of Kotlin. But it is very, very similar to Kotlin in the many aspects and the functionalities it provides.
So then the next question is, if Kotlin is pretty similar to Groovy, did you consider just using Groovy?
No, yes and no. No, because it's a dynamic language. And, you know, believe it or not, there are people in this world, some of them are even hipsters, that believe that static languages can provide you with some benefits that dynamic ones cannot provide you. So we wanted a statically typed language, for our case. So Groovy was kind of like, a no-go in that sense.
On the webpage, I noticed in the documentation, you have an area that compares Kotlin to Java and compares Kotlin to Scala. Was it that you were trying to sort of mix imperative and functional into one nice statically typed language?
There's different aspects to that. First of all, and I think there's still a disclaimer on that page. If we look at Scala, a lot of people, when they look at Kotlin, they're like, well, yeah, this is very similar to Scala, except Scala is more powerful and provides me with more possibilities of doing more things. Absolutely. And the disclaimer is, if you're happy with Scala, you don't need Kotlin. It's that plain and simple. You know, just continue to use Scala if you're happy with Scala. But where we distinguish ourselves from Scala is that we restrict you in certain aspects. We don't let you basically, you know, do whatever the hell you want with the language. So kind of like, as opposed to, you know, having any possibility to do any kind of weird DSL syntax construct, etc., Kotlin is somewhat more restricted in that sense. So a lot of people see this as a benefit, including ourselves, because it ends up when a lot of times you spend more time trying to figure out what is the correct way or the correct idiom to do something with a language as opposed to trying to solve the problem at hand. And that sometimes you have that issue with Scala. In fact, I think I was looking recently at a Twitter guideline, which was like 50, 60 pages, quite long. That was like, you know, guideline on how to use Scala, on what to do, what to not to do, coding standards, do this, do that. So you have that kind of issue. In terms of Java, so, you know, our primary target for Kotlin initially was the JVM and Java developers, primarily because we are Java developers ourselves, right? The people that write IntelliJ IDE and all of the different tools that you know are Java. They're writing Java. So we need to have that comparison to Java to kind of say, you know, this is what it would look like in Java. This is what it would look like in Kotlin. And here are the benefits of what you get from using Kotlin. And then in addition to that, we need to provide Java interoperability 100%. You know, we strive for the 100%, not 99.9, but 100, because we have 14 years of legacy source code that we need to interop with, and we cannot just throw it out and start writing from scratch. So we need to make sure that everything that we have can continue to be used. And much the same way for anyone that wants to get into Kotlin and, you know, can leverage a JVM platform.
And so what's the JavaScript story?
Because everyone and their mother was basically writing a language that targets JavaScript. So we thought that if we don't, we'll feel left out. and we needed to get the hipsters on board. So, no, I mean, jokes aside, kind of like eventually that would happen, right? Eventually someone from the community would target JavaScript. And we thought, hey, why don't we just provide it ourselves? And we spent a lot of time targeting the JVM, and now we're putting much more effort into JavaScript. And the benefit of us kind of doing it from, the get-go is that we are restricted now to making sure that what we do is compatible. So one of the goals of Kotlin is that basically code that you write using Kotlin and using the standard library of Kotlin can be compiled to JVM and can be compiled down to JavaScript. So effectively what that means that you can actually share source code, write it once and, use it from JavaScript and use it from the JVM, and you get that benefit, you know, especially, I mean, Scott, you've done AngularJS, you've done a lot of JavaScript development. I'm guessing all of you have, and you know that a lot of times you have to validate the same logic on the business side, on the client side, and on the server side. So mm-hmm. It's kind of leveraging that, saying, let me just write that once and be able to leverage it on both sides. So that's kind of the benefit that you get if we're trying to do that from day one, try and make sure that that happens.
Very good. So this would be something where I might write my validation logic to use on the server and the client, but maybe not necessarily have like a full typed definition of Angular and Ember or something like a lot of people do with TypeScript.
Yeah, so we actually use the same concept as I think it's called Definitely Typed. Is that the site?
Yep.
Yeah, so we're basically using that. And there will probably be wrappers around a lot of these libraries for those people that are more comfortable with the static typing on the server side. On the client side. But the goal of this sharing of the code is precisely that. So I, for example, can write some functions or a class with some functions in it, and then have that compiled down to the JVM. So I'm now using it. It's bytecode. It's 100% compatible bytecode on the JVM, and I'm consuming that from Kotlin or from Java. And then I also compile that down to JavaScript. And what that does, it uses the repeating module pattern to basically create Node.js or CommonJS compatible modules. And then you can just reference those and call those same functions. So of course, there are some things there that we need to like take care of. So for instance, on the server side, with Kotlin, you can have overloaded functions and you can have optional parameters. And these are things that you don't exist in JavaScript as such, right? Overloaded functions don't exist. So we have to take care of that. And then we follow conventions to like, if you name a function Joe, then you'll have a Joe, and then you have a Joe_1 and a Joe_2 and stuff like that. So that you basically get that same functionality on the client side. Although I'm not so much in favor of overloaded functions, but anyway.
Sure. There was some mention in the documentation about possibly a .NET target someday in the future. Is that still in a roadmap at all?
I wouldn't say that it's probably as much in the roadmap as a .NET IDE is on the roadmap. did I say anything there? No, I didn't. So I don't think that it's our primary target right now. To be honest with you, I've been in the Microsoft space for quite a long time, and having stepped out a little bit into the JVM space, I'm seeing so much activity, so many things going on. And for a long time, I just kind of thought it was all dead. It was all historical. It was everyone everyone over 65 writing code with going to pensioners' houses and stuff like that. I'm exaggerating, but I didn't really think that, there's much going on. And I'm like, whoa, no, actually this is quite a vibrant community, and there's so many things going on, which kind of explains everything that's come out in terms of languages on the JVM. So the JVM is a system that runs everywhere. It runs everywhere with an ask toolbar, but nonetheless it does run everywhere. So kind of like how much benefit would we get out of porting this to the CLR right now is kind of questionable. But having said that, Philip Laureano, who I know, I think you guys know, did start some effort to start getting that over to the CLR. But then I think he decided to delve deeper into how to obscure objects by not creating them and freeing them or something like that, because that's what he likes to do in his spare time. So I don't know how how that project is actually going right now.
Is it possible to run, and I've never messed with it, I just occasionally hear people talk about IKVM as a way of running Java on Mono and .NET.
I've tried it. I've taken a couple of Kotlin applications and I've run through it, and it does work. So it actually does work. But that too, I can't tell you whether if you take a full-blown application that uses a whole bunch of, Java classes and stuff like that, whether that's going to work completely well. But my kind of prototype things did work. And it was a little bit more than just a hello world. But again, not sure how realistic that is.
But I tried it a while back and running a couple of Java things on the KVM, but it was slow. at least in my perspective, this was a couple of years ago, granted, but it was very slow.
Yeah, I didn't do much in terms of performance test or anything like that.
I had questions. I don't know if we want to get into this about the choices in syntax and kind of the what I thought was interesting was the use of inference inside the functions. So you just declare things var or whatever.
Yeah.
But then you have annotations in like the function arguments.
Annotations for?
So like the hello world on there has args declared as an array of strings. But then, inside of there, you're just, okay, val x equals, integer parse int. And this is on some of the web demo things I'm looking for in here.
Oh,
and there's,
okay.
You know, like counter vars, you're not declaring as ints or anything. You're not declaring them as types, like in the for, like for a n, and then the range.
Yeah. Well, so the basically the idea here is the following, that one of the, you know, I mean, one of the goals of Kotlin is to be really concise, right? And it's to be, you know, I would say it needs to be more concise than Java, but that's not really setting the bar very high, right? Because, I mean, I think everything is more concise than Java. So having said that, we do try and make sure that the compiler can infer as much as possible. So you don't have to be explicit about the types. So, for instance, like when I'm writing Kotlin code, I hardly ever declare explicitly the types. So there's only certain places where the compiler forces you to be explicit about the types. Normally, if you just initialize a type, it will automatically, you know, infer the type. Initialize a variable, it will infer the type. But like, for example, in arguments to the functions, or in places where you have public properties, etc., then you have to be a little bit more explicit in terms of typing, defining the type of the argument. And then we have this, the top level object, that we have is the equivalent to object is any in Kotlin. So, you know, again, when the compiler can try and infer it, it will. So it can try and define the type. So you don't have to, be that explicit. It's the same as like another feature that Kotlin has, which is called the automatic casting. And basically what that does is that you imagine you have a function that you pass in an any. And then in that function, you say, if the object is of type customer, then, you know, call whatever on that customer. Now that's, you know, that is violating, I think it's the Liskov substitution principle. But the point there is that in C#, you would have to check to see if the type is of a certain type and then cast it to that type. Whereas in Kotlin, it does automatic casting. So it figures out that, okay, in the conditional, I've already checked that the type is of a specific type. So you don't need to explicitly cast it when you call a method on that variable, on that type.
All right. So you've been spending a lot of time in JVM land, and I imagine one of the advantages of using Kotlin is that you just get access to anything else that runs on the JVM. But is there anything specific that JetBrains has for Kotlin's, like specific libraries to do anything JetBrainish?
Okay, so yeah, we have a bunch of things that we've written internally that were like out there, and there's a bunch of things that are available that have been contributed by the community. So one of the deals again with Kotlin is that it's, you know, 100% interop with Java. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel over and over again, right? But there are already like, libraries. There's one that's called the Kara web framework, which basically takes the concept of Ruby on Rails and ports it to Kotlin. And what that does is basically, provide you with, you know, the backend and also like the controllers and the routing and the actions and all of that. But it also provides you with a front end in terms of view engines and CSS. So if you, I don't know if you've looked at the Kotlin website or, but if you know, you or your listeners just type HTML Groovy builders in Kotlin, what that does is take you to a site where you basically see HTML defined the way that Groovy defines it. So basically it's like HTML, but it's actually Groovy code. In the case of Kotlin, it is HTML and it's Kotlin code, and the difference is that it's statically typed. So each of those elements, an HTML, a head, title, all of these things are actual functions. So what that means is that now, what the Kara framework did, one of the guys, Andy, I think, is the guy that wrote it. What he did was basically use HTML, strongly typed HTML builders, and strongly typed CSS builders, to basically provide the entire framework. Now, personally, I'm not too much in favor of strongly typed HTML builders. I don't think, you know, I kind of like I don't know. I'm used to HTML. I do markdown, so for me, it's not a big deal. But where I do see value in that is in strongly typed CSS builders, because often we kind of try and go, and not so much for the strongly typed aspect, but for the object-oriented aspect, right? Because if you notice that, you know, one of the things we always complain about object orientation inheritance, and then we go way out of our way to kind of use SAS and less to get some of those benefits. And that basically, you know, you're writing SAS and then compiling that down to CSS. So here it would be basically the same thing. You are using strongly typed CSS builders and then letting Kotlin compile that down to actual CSS. So there's that. Then there's a framework that I've written, which is called Spec, which basically what it is a kind of like a specification framework, kind of like MSpec / Cucumber / I don't want to call it BDD, but let's say BDD framework. And then there's a bunch of other libraries that people are writing. So one of the things that Kotlin is very good for, in the sense that it cuts down a lot of code, we kind of actually say that about, you know, if you take a Java code base, you could cut down around 30 to 40% of your code by using Kotlin and still have it readable. So if you're doing Android development, a lot of boilerplate code is all of the event handlers, etc. And Kotlin, since it has support for lambdas, makes it much more concise. So there's a lot of helpers and libraries around Android, because a lot of people are actually using it for Android development, which is also Java 8, when it will bring the lambdas, it's not going to be available. Well, it has brought the lambdas, but it's not going to be available for Android development as yet.
Interesting. Anyone have any more Kotlin questions?
Well, I mean, I guess question on, you know, best place to get started. I mean, definitely the web demo is really cool. Is that what you kind of recommend? Are there any good, you know, like presentations or?
Yeah, so the best place to get started is, first of all, you buy an IntelliJ license from us, whether you want to use Kotlin or not. No. I'm actually working on publishing the new site, but Kotlin, surprisingly, despite the conspiracy theorist people, we've made it really, really easy that you don't actually need any tools to use Kotlin. If you go to the website, there's a link that takes you to a zip file, which is the wrapped up command line compiler. So I have actually done demos of Kotlin where I've just created a VI, used VI to create a file and then compile it and run it. It has support for most of the builders on the Java space, which is Ant, Gradle and Maven. So if you go to the website, from there you could just download the compiler. If you want a more IDE centric experience, then you can just download IntelliJ, either the open source community edition one, the free one, or the ultimate one, and use Kotlin from there. Or if you don't even want to install it, then you can go to the web demo, and there you can just run Kotlin and compile it down to both Java and JavaScript. The web demo does look like something that was done in the 80s, but we're getting that revamped to make it look much nicer. But the functionality is all there.
Mm. And then, you know, I've joked back and forth with you. You mentioned the installing Java, you know, it's, you know, everyone's favorite feature of the Ask toolbar. But you can install via Chocolaty. You mentioned on a blog post, I mean, if you install, I use Chocolaty install java.jdk. But if you install the JDK, you just get the developer stuff and not all the...
Yeah, if you actually install the JDK, you don't get the Ask toolbar. That's only the Java runtime environment that prompts you for the Java toolbar. And, you know, I'll be honest. Well, I'm always on. Okay, not always. Well, sometimes, and it doesn't matter. So I was actually having dinner with one of the guys from Oracle. And I was talking to him, and I said, dude, what's the deal with the Ask toolbar? And these were his words. I don't know if they're accurate or not, but he said to me that this wasn't an Oracle thing. This was prior to Oracle taking over Sun. Sun needed money, and apparently they got offered a boatload of money to put an Ask toolbar in the Java E runtime. And apparently also they need a boatload of money to get out of it. So they want to kind of just, you know, let it expire, and then just not have to do that anymore. So this was his words. I don't know how accurate that is, but I've had other people from the Java community and Oracle confirm that. So I'm guessing that it kind of makes sense. But you don't need that. That's just as you say, if you install it using Chocolaty, then you don't you don't get it either. My only issue there is trying to spell chocolatey.
Well, you can do C-I-N-S-T once you've got chocolatey installed, but I totally agree on that. One other frustration with Java in general is that it also installs the browser plugin. I mean, you can go in and disable that, right? But does the JDK install the browser Java plugin as well?
As far as I know, I don't think so. I'm not sure, actually, okay. Because I have to use the browser plugin because one of our products uses the applet, so it requires it. So, and I installed that as part of the JRE, but I don't know if it installs it. Actually, that is annoying sometimes because OS X kind of hiccups on that, and sometimes it doesn't version mismatch, and then the browser plugin stops working when you upgrade Java. But yeah.
What I've noticed is that you end up getting it, but it's not installed by default because right after the JDK or the SDK installs, it redirects you to a page to check your Java version.
Yeah.
And it says, oh, you need to install the Java browser plugin in whatever browser gets opened by default.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I thought it was an interesting way to kind of slide that in there too.
Yeah, I think, but the applet things really, it should just go away. It should just go away.
As long as I can host my ActiveX control inside of my applet, I think it will be okay.
Well, you know, actually, you know what you should do? We should maybe this would be a good startup idea to get. Now that this Docker thing is kind of, you know, on the move, maybe we should have a Docker container that contains ActiveX with a Java applet inside.
We need to write a Java applet that can host Docker apps, Docker there containers, and then we can just distribute, you know, Windows 95.
And then can I put my Silverlight inside of that or?
No, that's not supported.
I was trying to stay away from John. Silverlight. I really was. I wasn't going to say a word about Silverlight. But okay, you brought it up.
Let's talk about Nitra.
Oh, yeah. so
nice, what is nice Sieg segue there, yeah.
Yeah. So here's a funny thing because we get asked is actually is like, okay, you've got Nitra, you've got Kotlin, and you got MPS. And someone I think once said to me, they're like, isn't this kind of like when Microsoft had Entity Framework and Link to SQL and I don't know what? So no, yes and no, kind of no. I'll pretend I'll play safe and say no, it's not. So actually, you guys know about MPS, right? Have you heard about MPS?
No.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Okay. It's that thing that we've done that nobody seems to understand, including myself. But it's basically a metaprogramming system, and it's basically a language workbench where you get the whole stack. You get the IDE and you get everything, and then you use this language workbench to either create new languages or extend existing ones. So, for example, with MPS, Java 6 had the ability to have lambdas like 5-6 years ago. Right. And we've got quite a lot of customers that are using MPS. And it's an open source thing. And it's, you know, it's always been open source. And we've got customers using it. And we have agreements with customers, large and small, that are using MPS. And this runs on the JVM. Now, MPS isn't everybody's cup of tea, as the English would say. So Kotlin kind of falls into the no. We are going to actually write a language that we're going to use for our tools. And it's going to be a language that allows for easy DSLs, which is where people sometimes see overlap with MPS, but there isn't because they serve different purposes. And then now we have Nitra. And Nitra was basically the idea. Nitra was the guys that wrote Nemerly, which is an open source programming language. We were hired about a year ago or a little bit more by JetBrains to continue to work on a product that was called Nitra, which basically essentially allows you to define your own languages, and not only define languages, but define the ability to create tooling around those languages. And this is built the CLR, so it's for .NET. And Nitra is that thing that came out after more than 1.5 years of research and development. That's what the result is. And it's still not finished. We've just brought it to a point where we're comfortable enough with doing, with open sourcing it. And basically the intention from day one was to make it open source. So what Nitro basically allows to do, to kind of summarize, like, if I'm going to say that R word, Roslyn. So if you think about Roslyn, and Roslyn basically is a C sharp and a VB compiler. So what Nitro would be to Roslyn is kind of a generic tool that allows you to create a compiler for any language. And in addition to creating the compilers, it also allows you to build in aspects that allow for tooling. So it will have knowledge of refactorings. It will have knowledge of code analysis. It would have knowledge of a whole bunch of things, all of the things that we have with ReSharper. So that's kind of summed up in terms of what Nitro is. So whereas MPS is kind of its own language workbench with its own workbench, with its own tooling, Nitro is the possibility of you creating a grammar, from that grammar, creating the compilers and creating tooling around it to be able to then implement your GUI or your UI for the tools. Does that make any sense whatsoever?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Big silence there.
So what are people doing with Nitro? Like, how are people putting it to use?
So right now it's mostly us. We're still developing it. There's still a lot left to go on it. It was funny. I tried it 6-7 months ago. I was playing around with it, and I was talking to Vlad, the team lead, and I said, so what parts are you working on now? He's like, error recovery. Because error recovery apparently is very hard. And then, so I'm starting it out, I'm playing with it, I'm trying to extend C# by adding the question mark, symbol, kind of like we have in Kotlin. And then suddenly Visual Studio completely just vanishes. I mean, it just dies, it goes, bam, vanish. And I said, Vlad, Visual Studio, just completely vanished on me. And he just responded on Skype, error recovery. So that's what they're working on. Yeah, that's normal. Yeah. So right now, you know, it's still continuing to work. And to be completely honest with you, I don't see people really using Nitro outside of people like ourselves, like JetBrains, that are providing tooling. I don't honestly believe that a lot of people are going to go and create their own DSLs and then on top of these DSLs go and create their refactorings and stuff like that. And I know that, you know, a lot of people kind of believe that Roslyn is going to lead down to the same path. I honestly don't think that that's the case. So, you know, people will extend a little bit and create a DSL and stuff, but I don't think they want to go full blown and create tooling and things around it. So to be honest, the usage of Nitro right now would probably be targeted mainly at people like ourselves or people like, for example, that create frameworks, that integrate with other, tools, et cetera, and want to be able to provide support for those tools. That would be the kind of target audience. And it's still, there's still a lot of work on it. I mean, it's kind of like it is under the research and development kind of branch of JetBrains. It's not a product as such yet.
And, but I do see, like, on GitHub, there's Visual Studio extensions, there's some samples and tests and things. So it's definitely something that people can plunk around with, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can download it now and you get full support inside Visual Studio. It does use Nemerly. So, Nemerly already comes with a plugin for Visual Studio, so you will be able to use it and you will be able to run it in Visual Studio and run the tests and start to experiment with it and extend the C# language with new constructs and stuff. So all of that is already there. But, you know, there is still a lot of aspects in terms of tooling, et cetera, that needs to be provided in terms of the branch where it provides tooling for the language that you're building, kind of thing. It's very kind of like meta, if you will. Mm. That's why it's called meta.
Speaking of meta, I wanted to see your talk at NDC, Developing in a Decade.
Oh, that one. Yeah. So what happened? You got drunk?
Better no.
You let me down. I expected you there in the front row at 10 a.m. on the first day.
I know. I had my own talks bearing down on me.
Yeah,
but it's always good to sit in the front row and watch you talk with your gourmet coffee and skinny jeans, acting like a hipster. So I know you're really a closet hipster. That That's why you're saying.
I just need to buy another pair of skinny jeans. People keep saying all you do is wear the same skinny jeans. I'm actually looking for some mustard colored skinny jeans. I gotta find me some. I had that talk, which is actually quite a difficult talk to deliver, to be honest with you. It's kind of one of these, well, you're just you're full of it, or, well, yeah, that's actually a good point kind of talk.
Yes,
so it's not technical. So it's, because
reading the abstract, and maybe I got this wrong, but you were going to look ahead like 10 years and figure out where we were headed, right?
I mean, the background of this talk is the following. Like, last year, TDC, which is a conference, I don't know if you did it, Scott, a conference in Norway. They said to me, we'd like you to do a keynote about, what technologies and trends you feel will be using in 5 years from now. And I thought to myself, well, that's going to be a very, very empty talk, because what am I going to get up on stage and say, okay, we're going to be using functional programming, probably with some mix of reactive, restful microservices that connect to some, I don't know what. Where it did struck a chord with me is something that I have been thinking about for a couple of years, which is like, where are we heading in terms of society, in terms of like, are we pushing automation too far? Are we pushing information too far? And what this talk is about is kind of looking not so much about how we will be doing things or what we will actually be doing, but kind of questioning why is it that we're doing what we're doing. And that is kind of a little bit combined with a lot of the things that I've seen lately on the very popular technology sites, that it kind of has become, I don't know if you guys have this sense or feeling that nowadays people kind of value more or people get more credit for how many VC rounds a company gets, as opposed to what exactly that company is doing, and whether that thing that they're doing, not even question the fact that whether it helps people or not, but is actually valuable in the sense that, I'll just keep throwing VC money at this because one day someone will come and buy it for $50 billion. Which doesn't seem far-fetched nowadays to say that number. You don't sound like Dr. Evil when you say that. And then who cares what happens to it? Maybe, and then they'll probably get some cross-site scripting attack and everyone will go down. But so that's kind of where I've seen things are going. And when I started to think about this after I gave this talk, I started to get approached by a lot of people that were saying, hey, you know what? I'm actually doing good things. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And as I started to investigate, I started to see so many projects that are doing social good, that are actually helping people in one way or another. And I'm not exclusively talking about donating money, but actually doing things that potentially save lives, and in many cases do save lives, that aren't getting any attention whatsoever on these big media sites. Mm-hmm. And then as I did this talk, I did a short podcast with Scott Hanselman on it as well. And then I start to get approached by very large financial institutions that are saying, hey, we actually at this place have a 80-20% program, and 20% has to be dedicated to helping charities with pro bono work, which my job is paying for, right? Mm-hmm. And I start to see that, hey, there are so many people out there that are doing great things, that it isn't all about, Uber is going to come and make everyone, jobless. And, but also having said that, a lot of times when you talk about these things, people are going to say, well, what are you going to do? Stop innovation? Or, this is just another industrial revolution. And what I found out looking at some studies, and one of them is by MIT. And as I said in my talk, as soon as you stamp MIT on something, it's completely credible, that this is not actually like the next industrial revolution, in the sense that we are destroying jobs much faster than we are creating jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like sometimes us developers and us in IT take our lives for granted, and we don't really appreciate that, hey, tomorrow it can be us. It potentially can be us. I mean, one of the things that I discovered was there's more robots writing news nowadays on these big news sites than there are actually, than we thought of.
Yep.
That what we read and we think that is written by a journalist is actually written by a computer.
You know, it's funny. We've always complained, or at least, you know, for I don't know how many years now, we've complained about it's so difficult to get support at some of the large companies because you have to go through the automated voice menus and do this and do that. But years ago, I could remember if you at least got to a human being and explained a problem to them and talked to them one-on-one as a person, they would somehow know or have the business knowledge or have the power to be able to change things for you. The scary thing I've realized over the last year, a couple scenarios have had happened to me, is today you can still eventually get to a human, but they no longer have any power or even sometimes the business logic, domain expertise to do anything to help you. It's just like, well, that's how the system's set up and that's how it's going to be. Well, you know, could I talk to your supervisor? You know, that used to be the old trick. Sure, here's my supervisor, you know, and this person also, sorry, that's how it is. And there's nothing I can do to change it. I've had that happen more and more just because I think I don't know how this is going to come out as a phrase, but the computers are in control to a point where that part of the business just sort of runs on autopilot. And sure, the company's saving a lot of money because they can hire anybody off the street and just give them a few scripts to read from. But now that, you know, there's no one that can help me.
Yeah. I think that we are in such a position of privilege and we are taking our job for granted. And I'm not so certain that, I mean, you know, maybe in 15 years, our job is at risk as well. I mean, you know, that's not so far-fetched. I mean, you look at the auto-driving cars of Google, right? Just today, someone tweeted that they were saying, oh, you Uber, those guys protesting at Uber, oh, they're going to be in a right treat when the self-driving cars come. Well, when that happens, who's going to be out of a job? It's going to be truck drivers, right? It's going to be delivery vans, right?
I mean they're going to build a robot that can go to meetings for me?
Yeah.
And eat nachos. And
they'll just self-destruct each other, right?
That's our dystopian future. The humans will be consigned to just going to meetings all day long. And the robots
do the work. Oh, God. Actually, no. I don't know.
Hadi, I read an interesting article about, you mentioned earlier about that a large percentage of what we read now is being generated by computers. And one thing you don't think of, but like, sports articles, they were saying these are done, you know, tons of these are cranked out and they're actually using like sports jargon, you know, and they'll say so-and-so lofted a blah, blah, blah. And it's all like just pulled from the game stats. But one point they made there was that new content is being created that wouldn't before because nobody's going to like send a reporter out to write up a Little League game or, you know, a club sport game. But now we're able to do that. I mean, and I've also, you know, read some things saying that, you know, because you're now able to, you know, it used to take a whole day's work to feed your family. And now in a few minutes, you can at least get subsistence food to feed your family, like in a few minutes. And so now people are doing things like writing, you know, Wikipedia articles or lolcat generators or whatever it is, you know, some of it useful and a lot of it just killing time. But so I guess my point is maybe that we are
hosting podcasts.
Right. Well, now that we have more free time because things are being done for us, like we're creating more content and doing, is there value in that?
That's actually one of the points that I touch on in the talk because I don't know if you guys have read the book Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And he says that this is written in 1932 and he talks about we end up in a world where we are exposed to so much information that like the relevance, it becomes irrelevant. And something like that Neil Postman also talked about in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And he talks about the TV in his particular case. But you know, right now it's the internet. But the point is that you say that there is now content being generated around things that potentially before wouldn't be covered, right? And I say, how does that actually affect my life? One day to the next, to the point that right now we have so much content, so much things being generated that we are completely at a loss. I mean, you look at Twitter alone. Every day, I don't know if you saw that blog post, the 29 steps to a Twitter storm, which is like someone does something bad, someone points it out, famous person gets on board, a politician gets on board, the media coverage gets on board, someone writes about how you should not handle social media, and then all of this in the interval of 24 hours, and then next day something else happens, mm-hmm. right? And we end up with like in this amusement of like, you know, completely just overblown with information that we really don't care anymore about anything else. And I honestly, like, you know, this is a book that was written back in 1932. And it's kind of scary how it basically says that people are so amused and so entertained and are having like continuous sex, which, okay, is not happening all the time, but, they're well, having continuous sex. Okay. Well, I'm never home, man. Like, I'm sorry, dude. I'm never home. and like people are taking drugs. And there's artificial procreation. Now think of this. The guy said this in 1932, that there's artificial procreation and they're limiting people to different types of jobs and the dumb ones are going to get certain jobs and they're genetically modifying people. And you're kind of thinking, hey, you know, we're not that far fetched. So, you know, people always think about the 1984, you know, the big brothers watching you. Fortunately for us, that didn't become a reality. You know, there isn't some big government that is spying on us on a daily basis. But the other one, maybe. did my sarcasm come through there on the mic? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because it, on the sadder side of all this, so we're averaging what, one school shooting a week here in the U.S. Yeah. And at some point you're just kind of like, the only thing that's changed enough. Is the location. And eventually, you know, you worry that you're going to become numb to it. And you know, you have the predictable reactions by the same people that reacted the last time this happened.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, you have these people that will post a tweet that, you know, talking about the injustice in Palestine or Israel or insert country X here. And their next post is this breathless recap of the Xbox announcement at X, you know, at E3 and how they can't wait to get home and play something. And then their next tweet is, you know, something else that's totally irrelevant. And if it wasn't for the internet and 24-hour news cycles, they wouldn't have even known about.
Bingo. Bingo. And that's exactly what, in this book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, by Neil Postman, that's exactly what he talks about, but in reference to TV, he's like, the reporter comes out and says, you know, 10,000 people were just killed, by an earthquake, with a really like kind of serious face. And then 2 minutes later after that, it's like, oh, and now look at this kid jumping over a moose that's, you know, singing a Christmas carol and let's all laugh at that. And you're like, and basically saying that news has just become entertainment. It's just how much can we entertain people? That's what it's become. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, but it's exactly what you're saying. Tomorrow, no one's going to care about any school shootings anymore. It's another one happened. It's just going to become like murders. Who cares about murders happening in Chicago or in, you know, Kenya or in Spain? Nobody really cares anymore. Anyway.
Well, it wouldn't be a hottie show without a good rant. So,
why have I got that damn reputation? I don't rant.
I know. I'm just kidding. And I didn't want to diminish anything you said. I thought it was all good. It's just that we're running out of time. So, anything you want to talk about that's coming up? Any public appearances? Any?
No, I'm good.
I'm good.
I've already as you, I've got to, you know, you guys know I've got to go catch a plane and, so I got
to
wrap
this up. This is your opportunity to promote your personal brand and synergize yourself with your contemporaries while actualizing your agenda.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Let me think then. Dear me. I've written a framework. Can I mention that? No, I'm just kidding. Oh, I'll tell you what.
As long as it's a Node or a JavaScript front end framework.
Yo, damn it.
Otherwise, we don't care.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I really shouldn't say this because I shouldn't say that I told you so, but if you're giving me this 10 seconds to say it, I told you so. There, I feel so much more relieved. Yes, Microsoft, I told you so. You should have united those damn MVC controllers and web APIs into one. I told you that. But anyway.
Amen.
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 I'll put a link to your post in the
Yeah. You laugh, but I had someone just yesterday, I was trying to explain why, you know, her web API controller was not returning the view for her AngularJS app. No kidding. And she's a bright developer. Just got one too many controllers in her app.
Well,
and on that note,
yes, thank you for being on, sir.
Thank you, guys. I very much enjoyed it.
And thanks to everyone for listening. Tune in again sometime in the future. Because
when you hear Kevin Dente say,
I think they're certainly going to piss off a whole lot of people.